I begin the book with Thomas Paine. I close the book with Thomas Paine. It's actually a quote that Barack Obama used in his inaugural address. That's not why I used it. From Thomas Paine, we have it in our power to begin the world over again. And I think we do have it in our power to change the political system. But it's going to take the voices of the people.
Hello and welcome to today's forum at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Douglas Blackman, and today marks the official beginning of my tenure as host of the Miller Center Forum. I'm excited and honored to be here with you today and look forward to many future occasions on which I hope we'll bring together the finest scholars, journalists, and political leaders to discuss the most important issues of the day with our audience in the room and the thousands of you who are watching via our PBS affiliates and the internet. Before I introduce today's guest, I should also observe that we're taping this edition of the Miller Center Forum on President's Day, one of our oldest national holidays, established 212 years ago, initially to honor the birthday of George Washington, but later expanded to recognize both Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and ultimately the accomplishments and commitment of all U.S. presidents. The presidency, its history, and the most urgent matters it faces in contemporary times is at the heart of the work of the Miller Center, both in terms of the extraordinary scholarship of the faculty and researchers who work here, and in our efforts through the forum and other public programming to raise critical issues of public policy, and an especially important theme in these days, to encourage civility and sobriety in our national discourse. In its simple way, it seems to me that President's Day embodies just those intentions, to recognize the work of every president, regardless of party, and to respect those public servants and offer and the office itself in ways that ultimately encourage a healthy reverence for the most important democratic principles. Our guest today, Linda Killian, has strong feelings about just those sentiments. She is a journalist and senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and has been a columnist for Politico, U.S. News, and other major publications. Her earlier book, examining the freshman Republican representatives who stormed into Congress in 1994, elevating Representative Newt Gingrich to the speakership of the House, and nearly 20 years later to his current candidacy for the GOP nomination for president. Her current work, The Swing Vote, The Untapped Power of Independence, examines the forces underlying the seemingly vexing inability of the two major parties to either work together or prevail separately. She analyzes in her book the emergence of key factions of unaffiliated voters, probes how their attitudes are likely to shape the outcome of the 2012 presidential campaign, implicitly questions whether the two-party system may be irretrievably broken, and she offers, I think, a call to arms, though I'll let her explain this, for those centrist American voters. Her book left me anxious to hear more. You can learn more about her by visiting her website at www.lindajkillian.com, and I hope you'll also remember to explore the Miller Center's website. But now let's hear from Linda Killian. Welcome to the Miller Center.
Well, it's a real honor to be here on Doug's first official day as director of the forum. So I'm very honored to be here. And of course, as you know, he wrote an amazing book. So I feel a little nervous about that, but and I'm sorry about the snow. It's great to see so many people here despite the snow last night. I feel a little responsible, even though they didn't get snow in Washington. I did an event at Politics and Prose in Washington, D.C. about a month ago, and they had snow and ice the night before a little bit. So somehow I feel like it's me that is bringing it. But anyway, I appreciate you coming despite that. I also watched Downton Abbey last night. Since we're going to be on PBS, I think I have to say I'm so happy the dog was okay on Downton Abbey. I said, so happy the dog was okay and that Matthew and Mary, all right, never mind. If you haven't seen, yeah, so I feel like I broke a cardinal rule.
The power was off. None of us saw it.
Oh, the power was off. All right, okay. So you'll get to see. It's a big, exciting ending. So I was trying to see if I could draw a parallel between Downton Abbey and my book, and I think I can. Maybe it's a little tortured. But, you know, as you know, Downton Abbey takes place during and after World War I. The world, the English world especially, was on the verge of sort of a revolution in terms of lifestyle and in terms of the working class and the creation of the middle class. And, you know, I wouldn't say that the elites, the upper class, were fought the revolution kicking and screaming, more like sort of clearing their throat and raising their eyebrows. But I think, I won't say that we're on the verge of a revolution here in terms of our political process. I wish we were, but I do know that we need one. And I do know that the political elites here would be kicking and screaming. The media, the political parties, the fundraisers, the people that make their living at politics are sort of vested in the system as it is. And I think perhaps by your presence here today, you sort of realize that the system is broken a bit, more than a bit, which is what I talk about in the book. I think that the elites, the political class, is a bit patronizing toward the independent voters. And they talk about them as not being as engaged, as not being as active, as not paying as much attention. And my assessment is that the political parties aren't giving them a reason to pay more attention, that they've been so turned off by what they're seeing that this is sort of their response. So, how many people in this room are independent voters? I'm just curious. So,
yes
and no. I don't know if that mirrors. The national average of all registered independent voters is 40%. So 40% of all registered voters are independents. That's more than either Democrats or Republicans. So I think you have to say that the system is broken when more people choose to disaffiliate and to be independents than they do Democrats or Republicans. It certainly represents something. And this was, I talk about this statistic in the book, but it was just verified by Gallup about a month ago, this 40% number. And it's rising. It's steadily rising. So they are the largest voting bloc in the nation. They absolutely determine the outcome of elections, certainly in swing states, certainly in states that are not sort of New York or Mississippi. They definitely determine the outcome of elections. And they are being ignored and underrepresented. And they don't have a say in how government and politics operates. Now, the media gives them lip service and talks incessantly about, is Obama or the Republican nominee going to win Ohio? But they don't talk about the issues that matter to independent voters. And at the beginning of the book, I quote some of the founders. I know I'm in Thomas Jefferson country. I do have some quotes from Thomas Jefferson. Including, I begin the Virginia, there's a chapter about Virginia in the book. I'll talk about that in a few minutes. There's a quote, I believe or I love the dreams of the future better than the dreams of the past. I should have the exact quote for you, I'm sorry. I also quote Thomas Paine a lot. I begin the book and I end the book with Thomas Paine. Because I feel that his spirit is very much what I wanted to evoke with the book. As you know, he wrote Common Sense, a founding document. It lit the fuse of the revolution. He called for a democratic republic to be governed by the people, which was a very revolutionary idea at that time, not only a democracy, but a republic. And it's my view that we need to return to that, that we're not there. We've somehow lost it over the years. And so that's why he wrote his book, For the People, Not the Elites, and I think in some way I wrote my book, For the People, Not the Elites. I think it's very accessible, and I quote a lot of independent voters in the book. You hear their voices from all over the country. So that was what propelled me into the idea of writing the book, the idea that politics was broken, that we needed to look at what was wrong in this country and how we might be able to fix it, that our system really needed help. So I reached out to independent voters all over the country, and I did sort of very, you know, on a shoestring budget, I did things like get voter lists. You know, it's public information when you register to vote, and I would get voter lists from the Secretary of State or the county registrar, and it would say if you're registered Republican, Democrat, or independent. And I would call up people in Ohio at 7 o'clock at night, and I would say, I'm a reporter from Washington. Would you like to talk to me about politics? And amazingly enough, most of them wanted to talk to this stranger about politics. And it was because they felt like no one was listening to them. And they were thrilled that someone cared about what they thought about the political system and what they thought was wrong with it. So that was one way I reached out to people, totally blind. I did focus groups. I reached out at universities, citizen groups, activists. Obviously, I talked to elected officials as well. So I tried to sort of run the gamut, and you hear their voices in the book. As I said, it is not a democratic system. It is not a fully democratic system. In half the states in the country, you cannot vote in primaries if you're not a Democrat or Republican. So if you are an independent voter, you can't participate in the primaries. You have no say about who the parties nominate. And so you just have to sort of take it, whatever they do, and then you can vote in the general elections. So I am a big advocate for open primaries. I think that's one reform that we very much need. I think the candidates we nominated would be very different if we had open primaries, because candidates in, and especially when you're talking about congressional districts, which are drawn very much to favor the two parties, they're done in backroom deals. Again, the public does not participate in most redistricting. Most of them don't even have public hearings for their when they do the redistricting, which is in most states, the governor and members of the state legislature sort of get together in a back room to decide how the congressional districts will be drawn. And there are only about 50 competitive congressional districts in the country that are what you would call true swing districts, which is why when you have an election like 2010, in which everyone said, oh, such a big change election, you know, less than 15% of the House of Representatives changed over, because the incumbents are so entrenched. And so once you win your party's nomination, you're almost assured of election in your congressional district because it's so overwhelmingly Republican or Democratic. So that's part of the problem. I think Ron Paul is a symptom of the frustration. I think a lot of people that are voting for Ron Paul when they have the chance in states where they can, Iowa and New Hampshire is an example of a state where independent voters can vote, and half of the voters who showed up for the New Hampshire primary were independent voters. I don't necessarily think they think Ron Paul should be president, but I think they're trying to send a message. They're trying to say we're frustrated. And he's talking a little differently. And he sounds to me like he's telling the truth about what he thinks, whether I agree with everything or not, and he doesn't sound like a typical politician. Because that was something I heard over and over from independent voters. They're tired of the negativity, they're tired of the name-calling, they're tired of the pablum and the sound bites that they get, and they want some truth-telling from their politicians. So he reflects that frustration. And they are also tired of the money. And they feel like over and over, whether I was having focus groups in New Hampshire or Ohio or Colorado, I heard the same thing from young voters, from older voters, from parents. It didn't matter. Across demographic groups, I heard the same thing. And they said, you know, money controls the system. I have no influence. You know, no one will listen to me. It's all about raising the money. And, you know, in the wake of the Citizens United decision, I think we see how horrible, how it's just exponentially 10 times worse. And that, you know, a millionaire or billionaire can bankroll a candidate. So it's quite serious. So in the swing vote, in order to sort of get my arms around some of these major problems, I picked four states to focus on that I thought represented true swing states and different regions of the country and different things. So I picked Colorado, Ohio, New Hampshire, and Virginia as my four states. They obviously will all be critical in 2012. I think they're all up for grabs in 2012. And I think I offer a new way of thinking and looking at the swing voters, who they are and what they want. As I mentioned, you have individual portraits of them. You hear their voices. I also have four types of voters. I've sort of classified them and looked at the demographics of who exactly the swing voters are. So my first group are NPR Republicans. These are affluent, well-educated, generally older Republicans who we used to call Rockefeller Republicans. They are very abundant in New England, but they really are all over the country. I would hazard to say there may be a few NPR Republicans in this room. And they are socially moderate. They don't believe that gay marriage and abortion and things, they would be sort of very distressed at this contraception fuss. They think that's a personal choice. And that they don't think the government has any business in that stuff. But they're very fiscally conservative. And they felt that during the Bush years, government and the Republican Congress, which was spending very much like a Democratic Congress, they felt that government was mismanaged. So a number of them voted for Barack Obama in 2008. But they were turned off by the health care reform. They were turned off by the explosion of, as they see it, of big government. And they're very much up for grabs this time around. They would naturally be Romney voters. But I don't know what's going to happen. Obviously, by the time this airs, who knows where the Republican nomination is going to stand. So I think they would be less naturally inclined to Rick Santorum. But they are definitely concerned about the growth of government spending and the deficit. The next group are what I call America First Democrats. And these are what we have thought of as Reagan Democrats in the past. They are their social economic portrait is quite different from the NPR Republicans. Working class, lower middle class, white, male, largely. The Rust Belt has a lot of them. Ohio is a state where these America First Democrats probably determine elections. In Ohio. Ohio is so key as a swing state because it's so average in every way. It has big cities, it has agriculture, it has a very diverse socio and ethnic breakdown. So it really is, and it swings. It's very moderate in temperament for the most part. And so it is a barometer. No Republican has ever won the White House with Ohio. I don't believe any Democrat has done it since John F. Kennedy. So it is definitely a barometer. And I personally think, I mean, there are different ways to do the Electoral College math, but I personally think the next president cannot win. Barack Obama can definitely not win the presidency without Ohio. The next group that I talk about are something called the Facebook generation, and these would be voters under 35. Voters under 35 are registered as independents in a higher percentage than any other age group. They don't necessarily, there are certainly conservative Republicans who are under 35. The Facebook generation doesn't necessarily swing, but in my interview, they tend to vote Democratic or not at all, a majority of them. But in my interviews with them, they said they would vote Republican if the Republicans gave them someone to vote for. You know, if the Republicans had someone who was socially more moderate, who did not make this social conservatism a bedrock, appealing to the Christian right, which is the base of the Republic, which has become the base of the Republican Party, I think young voters would be attracted, but the Republicans aren't giving them a reason to vote Republican. This Facebook generation definitely doesn't understand why there are only two political choices. You know, they have, you know, thousands, millions of choices in their entertainment lives, in every aspect of their lives, and they don't understand why we only have two political parties. And in doing my interviews for the book, it was actually the younger voters, more than any other age group, that said we need a third party, a fourth party, more of a parliamentary system, we need more choices. So I heard that often from the young voters. The last group of voters are the Starbucks moms and dads, who are the suburban voters. And these are the voters that I paired with Virginia. And these are now more than 50% of all voters in the country live in suburbs and exurbs. It used to be only about 30 years ago, it was more like 30%. So these are the power voters. Up for grabs, deciding elections. They voted, and I'll talk a little bit more when I talk about Virginia, but they swung wildly from 2006 to 2010. So they are absolutely the deciders. So my point is that the center is disappearing from politics, that especially from being represented in Congress. The two parties are further apart and more polarized than they have been in 100 years, and it's really time for us to do something. Now, again, just back to the Starbucks moms and dads, I just wanted to talk a little bit about Northern Virginia. Northern Virginia is what I focus on in the book. Because that would be the swing area. That's the area that really swings back and forth and decides elections. 30% of the state's population lives there. And it very much reflects the demographic changes in the New South. Loudoun and Fairfax counties are the richest counties in the nation, with a median income of $104,000. Fairfax County has more than 1 million people, and a third of them are foreign-born. Hispanics are 8% of Virginia's population, but the number is much higher in Northern Virginia. So as I was saying, in 1980, a third of the U.S. population lived in suburbs and exurbs. Now it's more than half. In 2006, they went narrowly for the Democrats. They voted for Obama in 2008, not by a huge margin, but by a couple of percentage points. But in 2010, it was a huge swing. 42% of suburban voters cast their ballots for Democrats and 55% for Republicans. They care about the economy, education, healthcare, and defense. Tom Perriello is in the book. He is not an example of a swing person. But I came down here to cover that race because I found that race very interesting. In 2010. And he was a liberal. He's an unabashed liberal. But he had a strain. He liked to talk about populist issues, about manufacturing and about the disappearance of our manufacturing base and the great sucking sound and this kind of thing. So he was a real fighter. And he outperformed his counterparts who were in similarly designed districts. He lost, but not by as much as a lot of other Democrats in 2010. So I don't think we've heard the last of Tom Perriello. And I attended a Tea Party meeting in which he he was pretty fearless. I don't know if I would have been this fearless in the face of a group of people who all pretty much despised him. And people stood up and said, I can't wait to vote you out of office, you know. And he held his ground. He didn't lose his temper. He kept his cool and answered their questions. So it was pretty interesting. And your Senate race, I have heard people say, your current Senate race between your former governor and between the former head of the DNC, I think will very much mirror the national. Again, I think Virginia is going to be a swing state in 2012. I think it's up for grabs. I think it will be down to the wire. And I think the Senate race here will mirror whoever wins the presidential race. I think that their candidate will probably win the Senate race. That's how close I think it will probably be. But the Virginian that I spent a lot of time with and that I think very much represents what I'm talking about and what I respect is Mark Warner, your senator and former governor. Who I think I just like him a lot. I think he's a tremendous guy. And Mark Warner is, a lot of Republicans will say that he's the only Democrat they ever voted for, or he's their favorite Democrat. He is, as you know, pro-business. When he was governor, he had a tradition of working with the Republicans. He was rated one of the best governors in the country, the state one of the best managed when he was governor. He had the benefit of some good economic times, but he had to balance the budget and make some cuts and raise taxes when he was governor, and he did it and remained popular. As you probably know, he was one of the founders of what is called the Gang of Six in Congress, which was an effort to try to come up with a bipartisan deficit reform plan. And they met, and I chronicle this in fairly great detail in the book, and they met for months, he and Saxby Chambliss of Georgia, and it was so kind of dismissed by the leadership. They got no respect. In fact, they got sort of active opposition to some extent from the leadership because the Republicans have a party line, the Democrats have a party line, and you stick to it. And that is the way Congress works. And they don't like these sort of rump efforts that are sort of challenging the leadership, which is what, in a way, this Gang of Six was trying to do. So in the end, they didn't really come up with anything. And I don't know where that effort stands, to tell you the truth, and I don't know what Mark Warner would say about that effort and where we go from here. But I do know that in 2013, I think it's probably unlikely that Congress will do anything substantive for the rest of this year. We've had it now. They came up with the deal for the extension of the payroll tax cuts and unemployment insurance. And I think that they're unlikely to do anything else substantive for the rest of the year because of the partisanship and the freeze and the inability, and it's an election year, and you know, for all these reasons. And so, you know, if you think about yourself and your own life, if you had a job and you did nothing for 8 months but were still getting paid, you know, do you think your boss would pay you for that job? And the voters are their bosses. And that's why I think we've seen this frustration with the voters trying to churn and trying to throw members of Congress out because they're so frustrated with the lack of action on major problems that we face. And I do know that this sounds a little dull, but I'm working on a tax reform piece for The Atlantic. And I was doing some interviews last week on it. And people seem to think in 2013 we'll get some action on this, on tax reform, only because there's going to be no choice. The deficit is so huge, and we are facing such serious problems that we kind of are boxed into a corner unless we do some entitlement reform and some tax reform and deal with some of these big issues. So perhaps after the election, we'll get some action on this stuff. And the only way to do it is in a bipartisan way. You can't do it in a partisan way. You know, we saw with health reform passed without a single Republican vote in the House or Senate. And that is just frankly not the way to do a major reform of any kind for this nation, because then you get the lawsuits by states, and you get, you know, the attacking, and you get, you don't have, you know, the people sort of fully behind you. So you need to do this stuff in a bipartisan way. So Congress, our politics, has become incredibly dysfunctional. The debt ceiling this past summer, I think that is frankly why the Republicans sort of caved in a little bit here on the extension of the payroll tax and unemployment, because they saw the poll numbers after that debt ceiling debacle this summer. And while Congress, as you know, has a 9% approval rating, which is a historic low that you can't even, I mean, who are the 9%, I guess, is the question. But while the public is critical of both Democrats and Republicans, they're slightly more critical of Republicans, according to the polling. And so I think the Republicans saw that and decided they had better do something. So, as I talked about, this incredible flack that congressional members get when they try to buck the system. And, Mark Warner is one example. Lisa Murkowski of Alaska is another example. I don't know if anyone sort of knows her story from 2010. She was challenged by a Tea Party member in her primary. She's a Republican. I wouldn't even really call her a moderate Republican. She voted with the leadership only 80% of the time in the previous Congress before 2010, and that was not sufficiently deemed Republican enough for the Tea Party folks. And so they ran a candidate against her. She had, Jim DeMint, a fellow Republican of her party, sitting with her in the Senate, raising money against her for a candidate, which is just an unprecedented kind of thing. She lost in the primary. But more than 50% of the voters in Alaska are independent voters, more than 50%. And so she said, this will not stand. She said, I'm running as a write-in candidate. And she did it, and she won. And she was the first person since Strom Thurmond to win a Senate seat as a write-in candidate. So it can be done, but she had the name recognition, she had the money. It is extraordinarily difficult for just an average run-of-the-mill independent to run as a candidate. It's just incredibly difficult. Because of the power of lobbyists, because of the power of campaign money. So, and you see, if any of you watch Stephen Colbert, I don't know if this is a room that particularly watches Stephen Colbert, but, he's been making a joke about these super PACs. But sadly, Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, these are some of the few people, these are supposed to be comedy shows, but in a way, it's some of it's some of the only truth-telling we're getting about where our political system really is, which is a sad commentary on how things are. So, the media, that gets me to the media, which is ever more shrill, rewards the outrageous, not the people like Mark Warner trying to work together. You don't see him on television that much. They're focusing on the horse race and the presidential campaign. They're not, I don't think, contributing positively to the discourse in most cases, certainly television and radio. And we hear from the Democratic and Republican politicians, but we don't hear from the middle. We don't hear from the independents. We don't hear, and over and over again, and invariably, either if I do an event or I'm watching television, everyone says, well, the country is polarized. That's all there is to it. There's left and right, the country is polarized. But the problem with it is it's not true. The Republican and Democratic parties are polarized. But there's this 40% of people in the middle that agree on a great deal. But they are not being represented. And so it's quite a serious situation, I think. I think the rise of groups like the Coffee Party, if people have heard of that group, No Labels, independentvoting.org, Americans Elect, which will get on the ballot, I would guess they have $20 million, and conceivably every state in the country will have a candidate. They could really shake up this race. These independent voters, remember, 19% of all voters voted for Ross Perot in 1992. And that's a significant chunk of voters. And that 20% is still looking for a home. And an independent candidate, I'm not saying an independent candidate could win, but could seriously affect the race in 2012. So anyway, I think the swing vote is a fun read. I don't know if I don't mean to be so serious. I think you meet a lot of interesting characters, whether it's a college student in Colorado or a policeman from Ohio or suburban parents in Virginia or a 90-year-old activist in New Hampshire who plans to keep going until she's 100, like Granny D, if any of you knew Granny D. So what I really hope with this book is that all those people who are fed up with the system, the independent voters and others, when they read this book, that they say, yes, someone gets it. That's the way I feel. And I do also include some ideas for how they can make their voices heard and push for change, like opening up primaries, like redistricting reform. So I hope, like, getting together in groups and showing up at public meetings and pushing your elected officials to be more cooperative, to be more sensible in their approach to government. So I dedicated the book to these people. And I close the book with a quote. I begin the book with Thomas Paine. I close the book with Thomas Paine. It's actually a quote that Barack Obama used in his inaugural address. That's not why I used it. From Thomas Paine, we have it in our power to begin the world over again. And I think we do have it in our power to change the political system. But it's going to take the voices of the people. So with that, I guess I'm ready for questions.
Thank you. For those who would like to ask a question of Linda, queue up behind Jeff there in the back, and I'll join you there in a minute. But as the moderator, I'll exercise my prerogative to ask the first question, and as the new moderator, I'm going to make it two questions, seizing on my advantage.
So I can keep track,
The first is, in terms of the need to move to the center, which you argue for very very decisively. But in an era in which the two parties really do stand for different things, which in the past wasn't as much the case in terms of the scale and engagement of government, the minimalist version versus the more maximalist version, can the two sides really cooperate when their essential positions are so profoundly different? Can they move to the center and still be true to their principles? And then the second question I would ask you is, in terms of these swing voters who are in the center, who I think you very, very articulately captured who they are, but are they also lazy voters? Are they people who want it both ways, oftentimes, and don't want to particularly participate in the process, don't want to do the hard work of democracy? And so, in fact, is that the group that we should see as the leaders of this next era?
Okay, they're both good questions. Let me see if I can sort of address them. Can we move to the center? I think not by electing different sort of people to Congress. I think we can't. I don't think in our present system, with the present sort of liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans and people in the center get massacred, you know, moderate Republicans they're not a vanishing breed among voters. They're there. They're totally there. But they are such an endangered species in Congress. And they have a giant target on their back, you know? And so as we saw in Delaware with Mike Castle, who you may know was governor of that state and then was a congressman for many years, a moderate Republican, who often worked with Democrats on bipartisan legislation, was for campaign finance reform and a lot of things that Republicans aren't generally for, ran for the Senate in Delaware in 2010, would have won overwhelmingly in a general election, was very popular in Delaware, but got Tea Partied by this kind of crazy woman, Christine O'Donnell, you know, who just got a fraction of the vote, was not a serious candidate for the general election. And it's you know, other moderates like Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins of Maine, they're terrified. Orrin Hatch, who is no moderate, you know, from Utah, is scared to death that he's going to get primaried by the Tea Party. So we can't move to the center until we get election reform and get more centrists elected to Congress who can cut the deals, work across the aisle, work in a bipartisan fashion. Until we hear the voices of the people, which sort of segues to your next question, which are the independent voters, lazy voters. And that is, you know, as I said, I think that's to some extent the inside the beltway political, not to criticize you, Doug, but I think that's very much, I mean, I was in an event with Charlie Cook last week, who blurbed the book and who is, he's a terrific guy. And he is just brilliant when it comes to sort of predicting who's up and who's down and who's going to win congressional districts. And he's a numbers guy. And I brought up independents, and he said, you know, and I said, independent voters watched the Republican primaries in the lowest percentage. Even Democratic voters watched the Republican primaries in a higher percentage than independents. And they don't tend to pay attention until the fall. But that's because they don't have any say in the primaries. So why should they pay attention in a way? You settle your primary, you get a nominee, and then I'll pay attention. And I think to a certain extent, the electoral rules are stacked against independents. I think they're turned off by, as I said, the negativity, the money, all of this kind of thing. So while independents don't tend to be as activist as a lot of registered Republicans and Democrats who have a real stake in their party, I don't think that means they can't be. And I would urge them to be. I mean, I think as in Doug's introduction, he said, this book is a sort of a call to arms, and that's the title of the last chapter. And I would like to call these independents to arms, you know? I don't know that I'm a spokesman for the independents around the country, but what I've also said is that they cannot expect a messiah to come and save them. They have got to do it themselves. You know, they can't expect some savior to come and say, I'm going to swoop in and represent the independents, and, you know, they've got to make their voices heard. That's all there is to it, and democracy is a participatory sport. So that's my answer.
Hi, thank you so much. You pointed to an interesting tension in terms of representation, in the sense that you speak of swing voters as the deciders, and there would be one argument that would think if you're this deciding voice, that in some ways that the politicians are going to be paying more attention to you and seeking in greater ways to reflect your views. So I guess my first question is why you think what you think is going on there and whether that's not happening. And I guess I have a second sort of institutional question that relates to that. Is part of what's going on here, at least at the presidential level, relating to the geographic disbursement of independent voters? You said that there's 40% independent voters across the country, but of course the Electoral College affects how those independent voters translate into outcomes. So do you consider Electoral College reform, for example, as a way to help express this independent voice? Thank you.
Well, they are the deciders. The swing voters are the deciders in general elections, but unfortunately, the politicians have figured out how to pay lip service to them. And ultimately, they will have to vote for one or the other. You know, they don't, although like I said, Americans elect, they could have another choice this time around. What happens is, once they have, and I sort of use this analogy, I hope this isn't too racy for the Wilson Center. In the book, I use an analogy of, it's kind of like a one-night stand, you know? And the politicians kind of woo the independents, but then the minute they have what they want, the minute they have the election, they ignore them. They turn their back on them. Because what matters to them once they're elected are who are the fundraisers, who are the lobbyists that are raising money for me, who are the party people that are the MoveOn.org and the Tea Party people that are going to go online and scream if I don't do what they want me to do. And you know, Mark Warner has experienced that with the liberal wing of the Democratic Party when he dares to say anything critical about the Democratic Party. So they have to keep their base of supporters happy to raise the money and to do what they need to do to function in the system. So that's why they, you know, they have such a hard time and why the independent voters don't have a voice. In terms of electoral college reform, I think that's a very interesting question, and I've been asked that. I did C-SPAN a few weeks ago, and someone called in and asked me about that. Invariably, someone brings that up. I don't address it in the book, but I think it's a good question. And obviously, it would take a constitutional amendment. I mean, there really, I don't know any other way to get rid of the Electoral College, but it would lead to a more democratic form of electing a president, obviously. So thank you for your questions.
And after your lecture, I say amen.
Good. Great.
The context of the education of the American public, the average reading level of the United States is about the fifth or sixth grade. And I think this has something to do with what you discovered or will happen. I happen to understand that Laura Bush has asked Jeb Bush to run for president about a month ago. And I wondered what you thought about that, because he has name recognition and his wife is Spanish. And secondly, you said that the collapse of American politics, what does this have to do with the collapse of American imperialism?
Jeb Bush is not, thank you for your question. Jeb Bush is not gonna run. He doesn't want to, for whatever reason. So everything I've heard is that he's not interested in running this time. You know, a lot of the, part of the sort of churning in the Republican primaries are that, you know, obviously Republican voters aren't sold on Mitt Romney. And they're looking for someone else, and they've turned to virtually every other candidate in the field, and then they decide they're not that thrilled about them either. So, you know, the sort of dream team that didn't run, you know, whether it's Chris Christie or whether it's Mitch Daniels. You know, Mitch Daniels, the governor of Indiana, gave what I thought was a terrific response to the State of the Union. I don't know if anybody saw it. And I don't know if Mitch Daniels is like, and I'm not a Democrat, but a centrist, like he's the favorite Republican for the centrists or for the Democrats, you know? And he doesn't seem to get the respect he's not conservative enough, he's not wild-eyed enough, he's not attacking enough. He makes too much sense to appeal, you know, to the right wing of the Republican Party. So, you know, and I guess his wife didn't want him to run. I guess there were other issues. But, you know, he makes a lot of sense. And he is very, I don't know, he would probably object to my calling him a centrist, but I think he, you know, has a history of working in a bipartisan way and is very sensible, but that's not the kind of candidate the Republicans want to nominate. So
let's take a question from the internet.
From
Emily Levy, a UVA graduate in Chicago. She asks, What do you think is the primary catalyst for this surge in the number of independent swing voters? And I'd add, when did this begin? How did this come to pass?
Well, it's been going on. I mean, again, I don't think we have really good, reliable tracking that goes earlier than about 1960 on this. I think that's sort of where our good, reliable tracking of voter registration and that kind of thing and polling starts. And I think it's about doubled since then. So it's been steadily kind of creeping up. I think, he asked about American imperialism. That was his other question. And it's relevant to what I'm about to say on this. I think the increase in independent voters is exactly related to the dysfunction of our government. I think you can exactly correlate them. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons why the U.S. economy is in trouble. And there are a lot of reasons why India and China are conceivably going to be at least the next economic superpowers, if not the next military ones. We do spend an awful lot on defense compared to other nations. So that does suck up a big chunk of our GDP. And we haven't been as prudent as a nation or as a government as we should have been when it comes to spending, when it comes to saving on an individual level or going into debt or taking out a mortgage on a house we couldn't afford. And on the national level, on spending what we don't have and going into debt and having this trillion-dollar surplus. So we need to sort of get our act together if we're going to compete, I think, in the 21st century. And it's going to be hard. It's going to be painful. You know, tax reform, you know, only 6% of U.S. households earn more than $250,000, something like that. So we can definitely tax the rich, and we can definitely raise the capital gains tax rate, which I think is a good thing. It was much higher in the Reagan and Clinton years when we had a very good economy. Clinton actually raised the capital gains tax in the 1987 tax reform. In the 1987 tax reform. Reagan worked with the Democratic Congress and did a lot of things. But middle class taxpayers get the bulk of benefits from the tax code, whether it's mortgage deduction or Social Security, or, you know, they are getting the bulk of benefits, and the pain is going to have to be shared to sort of get our house in order, which again is not like a feel-good message, and is something that the Democratic and Republican politicians don't really want to say publicly.
Hi, Rachel Moran, Miller Center Fellow. I'm wondering how you reconcile the idea of an increasingly polarized Democratic and Republican Party with the narrative of a move to the right in general American politics. So in particular, I've seen you've spoken a lot about the polarity within the Republican Party. It's tough to be a Republican moderate right now, and we pay a lot of attention to Republican extremists or other extremists. But I didn't see you make that same discussion or have that same discussion about Democrats. And I think over and over recently, we see Democrats in office moving center, whether it's something like just, you know, the joke of single-payer healthcare to just last week's Obama's compromise on contraception and insurance. I'm not sure how you see polarity there.
When I started the book, I started with the viewpoint that both parties were equally responsible for our polarization, that both parties had moved to the extremes. And I started with that in mind. But in doing the reporting for the book, I have to say, I think the Republicans are a little worse. Because I think the Democrats kind of did their extremism and cleansing in this. You know, the Democrats moved to the left in the 70s. That's when the Democrats moved to the left. And when they, you know, in the post-Watergate, Vietnam, racial, feminism, all of these sort of issues that the Democrats were dealing with, that, you know, you had the campaign of George McGovern, you know, you had, the Democratic Party was dealing with that sort of thing in the 70s. And I think it's not easy to be a Democratic moderate, and I talked about Mark Warner. And, you know, a bunch of Democratic moderates lost in 2010. They lost because they were in tough districts. They were in swing districts, and Nancy Pelosi kind of screwed them on some things and made them take tough votes. And she is from San Francisco. How does she know what it's like to run in a swing district as a Democrat? So they lost. So, and Blanche Lambert Lincoln was an example of a Democratic moderate who was primaried and who the unions targeted, a conservative to moderate Democrat from Arkansas, senator. So it is hard to be a Democratic moderate, but I think my view is Democratic moderates are kind of ignored and told to go sit in the corner, but they're tolerated. And I think Republican moderates are actively driven out of the party as candidates. And I think that's the difference in the two parties.
One last question.
Thank you so very much for your talk. It was a very enjoyable lecture. I just had one question. Most of the issues that you discussed as leading to this sort of increase in the independence and the polarization of the parties themselves were social issues. And I was wondering, when I hear socialists, and a lot of times with the far right of the Republican, obviously we associate that with the Christian right and the Bible Belt. And I was wondering what you thought then the role of religion was in creating this this polarization, as a lot of these issues do break apart on religious lines, and whether or not you thought that, Gacy, if, I know it's a difficult question, but to assign a value judgment sort of and say that, you know, this really big issue that's affecting our national politics is being divided upon a religious line, whether or not that was a good, bad, if that was fixable. So just thank you.
Well, I used this line in the last, I gave a lecture at the Wilson Center last week, and I said that I don't think Democrats should be afraid to talk about God and patriotism, because the Republican Party doesn't own God and patriotism. And I think it's a big mistake for the Democrats to shy away from that. Now, I'm not saying they need to say God, God, God every third word, but there are plenty of people of faith who are Democrats. I'm from New England, and I think we have a different relationship with faith, perhaps, than people in the South. And I think that we think it's a private matter, and we don't need to be talking about it all the time. And we can still be have faith and be religious and go to church and that kind of thing. But we don't need to, and it's, you know, kind of the John Adams view, you know, of where faith should be in our, and I think it's the Thomas Jefferson view too, of where faith should be in our public discourse. And, you know, I think the Republicans use it as a weapon. That's my personal view of it. And I am personally, as a woman, I guess, very offended by this recent birth control thing. And I wrote an op-ed about this. Excuse me. I mean, 98% of all Catholic women, sexually active Catholic women, same percentage as women of every other religion, use birth control. And so when the Republicans talk about Obama is, and he did compromise, but, you know, when the Republicans talk about the Democrats are attacking religion, I say, what, are they attacking the religious or are they attacking the Vatican? You know, are they attacking the parishioners who are exercising their rights, their practical rights over religious dogma in their choices? That's sort of my view, I think. Religion is a personal thing, and on some level, I don't think it belongs in politics. And that's only my personal view. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming to the Miller Center.